Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Tanette Powell, co-founder and chief executive officer of The Truth Heals, a nonprofit advocacy group for women and youth affected by fatherlessness, and the author of The Other Woman, about her father's drug addiction and its effects on her, and From Daddyless to Destiny, Finding Freedom in Your Story. She'll speak on the topic, The Truth Heals, One Woman's Journey to Wholeness. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 9, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Kelly Keller, the director of the Center for Faith Studies.
This year's speaker series centers around the theme, Will You Let Me Dwell With You? Opening our hearts to each other's stories. In the Abrahamic story, God is, I think, inexplicably forgiving of the people who never seem to listen, never seem to remember their own story, constantly need to be retold. God asks the people, "Will you let me dwell with you?" In our series, we are inviting speakers with different stories to tell, of relational and societal brokenness that can often be uncomfortable. We are asked to let those ideas dwell with us as well, without easy answers and fixes. We are being invited to honest relationship, acknowledging that which has caused pain before trying to fix the systems going forward. Our speaker this evening, Tanette Powell, is a Mamaha blogger whose blog has appeared on Huffington Post and Washington Post, author of The Other Woman and From Daddyless to Destiny, as well as a wonderful children's history book for the Omaha Public Schools on the contributions of African-American people in Omaha at home during World War II. It's a fantastic text. An entrepreneur, mother of two, soon to be three. She and her mother founded the Truth Heals Foundation, which is now spreading not only in Omaha, but to San Antonio and possibly California and New York. So she has dedicated her life to reaching out to others facing the same difficult road or similar roads. She teaches at Girls Inc., Omaha Street School. She will share her personal conviction that the truth, even when it's ugly, can heal when it is shared and allowed to dwell in sacred space. Please help me welcome Tanette. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So, as she said, my name is Tanette Powell, and it is such a pleasure and an honor to be here tonight. And when I thought about the theme for this year, you know, will you dwell with me, that really, really stuck with me. It's something that I've thought about for a while, and at first I thought about, you know, maybe I need to have some type of distraction, like a PowerPoint or some type of other music and things like that. But when we think about dwelling with each other and just listening, existing together, hearing one another's stories, tonight my story, I think that we just need to have a conversation. It needs to just be us. And so we can put our phones away, we can put all those things away, and we can truly just listen to each other. And I think that, you know, that's how it was. And that's how it was when you look at all the stories from the Bible and you look at all of some of the remarkable things that have happened. It came from just conversations like we're going to have tonight. And so I ask that you embrace that tonight. And so the theme that I have just for tonight is The Truth Heals, One Woman's Journey to Wholeness. And earlier this week, I asked several friends, I said, what's the first thing that comes to your mind when you think about wholeness? And people said words like fulfillment. And I like that, full, fulfillment. People said words like, you know, peace, comfort. Things like you have it together. And those are all things and those are all thoughts that I felt when I think about the word wholeness as well. And so we'll talk about wholeness. Specifically, we'll look at my life because The thing was that I always felt like I was born on empty, born on E. And I spent so much of my early life trying to figure out, how do I get to full? How do I get to that F? You know, what kind of gas does it take to get to that, you know, that fullness and that wholeness? And I guess what I learned along the way, and this is how I categorize my journey, I categorize it in three ways. I call it TLC. Tell your story, let it go, and create a new story. And so tonight we're going to take that journey on my life. I'm going to tell you guys my story. I'm going to talk to you about how I let it go, and other terms, how I released that so it didn't have power over me anymore. And then finally, what I did to create a new story. And I hope that even if our stories are nothing alike, that you still find yourself in something that I say. Because it doesn't matter if you've had to overcome cancer, overcome high school or trying to get out of college, overcome a divorce or overcome a, you know, a friendship or a death, all of these things, you still have to go through that process. So we're going to start with tell your story. It's got to be a nightmare. It's got to be a dream. Envisioning a father transform into a fiend. He rapes his family of their goods and flirts with the world. He traded in his baby girl for that white girl. Always told her that he loved her most. My daddy loves me. Jokingly, she boasts, but the truth backs it down. It has her in the post. Run into the arms of the past, but he's a ghost. And how is she supposed to conquer and be strong when the one man that she loves has done her wrong? Promising to stop and be a better father. You're tiptoeing out to pawn the VCR. He's out 3 days, that's 72 hours. Crazy to see how much food he devours. Gulping down vinegar to clean out his system. She runs to the door. I guess she missed him. That's the story of my relationship with my father. I'm originally from San Antonio, Texas, and 2 years before I was born, my father started using crack cocaine. And that was very, very difficult. Very, very difficult for, you know, anyone who had started using that drug in those late 70s, early 80s. That was a tough thing. Everybody knows it as the crack epidemic. And my father was amongst that group of people who made some very bad decisions because there was very little information about the harms and the effects and the things that crack cocaine could do to your body and just how addictive it was. And my mother and him and my mother were married. And so even though he had a drug addiction, my mother still went on and had me 2 years later after he started using that drugs and went on to have my younger brother. And we grew up in a very, very chaotic environment. My father's drug addiction, you know, it put him in a state of mind where he wanted to take everything that we had. That was one Christmas. It was Christmas Eve. And he had been doing better. He had been clean for about a month. It seemed really, really great. I never, you know, I was really, really young, but my mom tells this story to me, and we talked about this story a lot. My dad was so excited. They went, you know, Christmas shopping the morning of Christmas Eve, and they had all of these toys. They had them stuffed in the trunk of the car. Like, I had an older brother, and he was like, you know, my mom said, this is going to be his best Christmas. Every Christmas before that had been very humbling because my parents were very, very poor. So they thought, this is the chance. This is the opportunity for us to have that Christmas we always thought about. So they had all these toys in the trunk, and, you know, they left them in the trunk. And my mom, she was carrying me because I was still very young. And, you know, my dad, we all went inside the house. We were getting ready for our Christmas Eve party. And in San Antonio, at my mom's house, every year, we have a very, very big Christmas Eve party. It's the biggest thing where family and friends, you know, pile into a house that only is probably supposed to hold about 15 and maybe about 50 or 60 people are in there. You know, we make enchiladas because in San Antonio, it's all about Mexican food. So enchiladas is the staple for Christmas Eve, which might sound, you know, something very uncommon here, but that's what it was. And so my aunt, she didn't have a ride. She said, hey, you know, to my mother, do you think that Bruce, which is my father's name, that he can come pick us up? And she said, oh, yeah, he'll come. He'll be on his way. So my dad was excited. He was like, you know, this is my year. I'm clean now. I'm going to go pick her up. So he gets in the car and he drives off. And an hour goes by, 2 hours goes by. And my Aunt Tandy calls my mom and she says, Delaine, Bruce never came. My mom says, you know, okay, well, can you get a ride with someone else? Well, the night goes by, we're partying, we're singing, you know, Natalie Cole, This Will Be, and all of those old songs. And so my dad never shows up. And remember, if you remember the beginning of that, there were all the toys in the trunk of the car, all the Christmas gifts in the trunk of the car. And a little after midnight, my grandmother called my mother and said, Tulane, someone saw him in the projects selling toys out of the trunk of his car. And that was Christmas for us, my first Christmas. It was my father selling the toys out of the trunk of the car and waking up with my oldest brother having no toys, no gifts, and me having one unwrapped baby doll that was not a part of that toys in the trunk. And so that was difficult. Because on one hand, while you saw that destruction and you saw that man that was, you know, so trapped by his addiction, you also saw a good man. When he was clean, my dad was great. He was he was the smartest man I ever met. If you wanted him to tell you anything about any story in the Bible, that's who you went to. If you wanted any piece of wisdom, any of that, you went to my dad. He always had a way with words. And so there was a piece of me that wanted him, that always wanted him around. But by the time I was 5, he started going to prison. And all through elementary, he was in prison. And all through middle school, he was in prison. And all through my high school, he was in prison. And for so long, I thought, my dad, he was that thing, that gas, that fuel that got me on F. And when he went to prison, I felt like, well, now I'm back on E. Every time he went back to the streets, I felt like, now I'm back on E. I'm empty. How do I make myself whole again? And so as early as 4 years old, I started trying to seek attention. And I didn't know. I just knew that something was missing inside of me. And so I thought it would be little boyfriends at school. So that was me, the little 4-year-old, 5-year-old girl running around saying everybody was my boyfriend and really trying to mean it. You know, I was the kid in class who always got in trouble. You know, my first grade year, I never forget, I was sitting in the class and the teacher, you know, she said, who wants to read? And I was always the kid who wants to read. So now that I have books and I get to read, I love it. I read all the time. But I was the kid and they were like, well, someone else besides Tanette. And I was like, oh, I don't get the attention. I don't get to read this time. So instead of just taking that and sitting down and letting someone else read, I disrupted the entire classroom. Threw over my desk. I just did everything. Threw stuff. So suspensions became a regular thing. But it still was attention to me. And even though it wasn't that good attention, it was enough. And then when I was 9 years old, that wanted that need for attention went somewhere else. It was another Christmas holiday, and my father was in prison. And my oldest brother, who was a little bit older than me, he was in high school. He had a lot of friends coming in and out of the house, spending the night. And so on one of those nights, one of his good friends spent the night, and he came into my room, and I was molested at 9. And that was really difficult for me because by 9, I was that kid that people said, you know, something's wrong with her. She is not okay. She's a terrible child. I knew nobody would believe me. And so I just kept that in. I carried that truth and I told myself, you made it up. I did everything I could to tell myself that, you know what, this was not reality. And even if it was, you probably deserved it. And so I went through life. The girl who wanted a father, the girl who was molested, the girl who was in so much need for attention. And somehow, I was always pretty smart, so I made it to high school. And then when I got in high school, I started dating this guy. And I knew from the beginning that he was never any good for me. But it doesn't matter when you want attention. It doesn't matter when you feel like you're so empty. There were all the signs there. He didn't have anything going for him. He was barely making it in school, so I knew that he wasn't going to be that, you know, thing that made me feel whole, but he was going to be a placement holder, right? It was going to be just enough. And so we started dating, and with us dating, we started skipping school because, again, he didn't have any big goals for himself. I didn't have any big goals for myself, so I would skip school all the time, never thinking that this was going to come back or anything was going to happen because of that. And then my senior year of high school, while everybody's getting ready to graduate, I get called down to the office and they say, you're not going to graduate. So you're not going to graduate unless you make up every day that you skipped. And I skipped a lot. And they said, in addition to that, you're going to have to meet with a probation officer, pay a fine, and then we'll decide if, you know, you'll be able to graduate. So pay a fine meant my mother was going to pay a fine because I was in high school and I did not have a job. So I went through that whole process, and that was the moment that I started thinking to myself, okay, this is not what I want for myself. But when you say this is not what you want, you have to start thinking about what do you want? And I didn't really have that in my head, so even though I knew it wasn't that, you know, I didn't know what I wanted. So I tried to get involved in stuff. I joined the school newspaper my senior year of high school. I made up all those days. You know, it sounded real good. It was like, oh my goodness, you know, she's writing for the newspaper. She's going on to college. This is great. She made up all those days she skipped. And I made it. I got accepted into the University of Missouri at Columbia. And I thought, wow, I get to go to a school out of state. No, they lack diversity. That's why I got in, okay? They lack diversity. So it wasn't because my SAT score met it. It did not. It was only because they lacked diversity, and they knew that if I was coming from out of state, they were going to get $20,000 a year from me. I had no clue. But I thought, oh, this is where I'm going. This sounds like I made it. I can forget about everything I did. Even though I didn't change who I was, I thought to myself, I'm making it. So my mom lets me go. She doesn't even care about the $20,000 a year. She's just trying to see me do something with myself. So she sends me off to Missouri. And the first week I'm there, you would think you want to get your books, meet some college students, get accustomed to the campus. I was trying to find the nearest projects. I was. It's serious. I'll never forget, we were driving down the street. It was two people that I was going to college with, and I saw these kids playing basketball, and I'm like, what's that? They were like, you don't want to go there. That's the projects. I said, drop me off. They were like, okay, we're going to drop you off. So they dropped me off, and that's where I started hanging out. When I was supposed to be in my English class, I was in the projects. When I was supposed to be going to biology, I was in the projects. Of course, I ended up on academic probation. And 2 years into my time at the University of Missouri, my mother said, we can't do this anymore. You're on academic probation every semester, and I'm paying way too much money. So she sent me back to San Antonio. And it hurt because when you go back, there's all the people that say, oh, we were right about you. You're never going to do anything. You're never going to amount to anything. And what I realized at that moment was it was never about the opportunities for me. Because even though I came from a very, very poor neighborhood, and even though, you know, I had a father who was on drugs and a mother with a very, very limited education and poor, poor credit, I had a lot of opportunities presented. But I still had so much caged inside of me. I had so much I was dealing with. I'd never told anybody that I was molested. I'd never told anybody that I felt this emptiness, and I had never given it to God, never. And so I started searching for myself at that point. It started to become what's going on with me. And the little poem I gave you there a few minutes ago, that really, really was what got me where I am. That was that real breaking point, because I never forget, I sat down and I started writing. And when I started writing, that started coming out of me. And I thought to myself, all these years, I never looked at my life and realized that my father's absence affected me. I never realized that his drug addiction, even though I would cry every time he got arrested, even though I wanted him to be at my graduation and he was not at my graduation, even though I wanted him at all these events that he was never at, I never put it all together that A plus B, you know, and all this equaled each other. So I never did that. And when I started to do that, that's when I went to the second phase, letting it go. How do you let it go? And that was difficult. The letting it go part is very, very difficult. It's where you have to say that, you know what, I can't make any more excuses first. I got to look at myself. I have to deal with myself. I have to admit that all of these things matter, but then I have to let go of all the power that they've been having on my life. And so I started to do that through a series of things. I started going back to church very regularly. I started getting back involved because for so long, you know, I would go to church. I was that Sunday church goer. You know, I was raised in the church, so it felt odd not being at church on Sundays or people saying, you know, why weren't you there? But I was just there. I was just sitting there. I was just listening, letting it come on, you know, fall onto my ears, but I wasn't really taking it in. I got rebaptized as an adult. And that meant a lot to me because I actually started to think to myself, what is this all about? Of course you grew up in the church. I can tell you a lot of scriptures, right? I can tell you all of that stuff, but what does it actually all mean? And when we start thinking about that wholeness, that was the first time that I started thinking about wholeness and fulfillment in another way. That no individual could make me whole. It took me a long time to get to that place. No individual could make me whole. It wasn't going to be some boyfriend. None of my hobbies. I liked basketball a lot. It couldn't make me whole. I liked writing a lot. It could not make me whole. None of those things. It wasn't going to be a good job that paid well. It wasn't going to be any of those things that were going to make me whole. I needed something higher. I needed something more. It wasn't going to be a drug, any of those things. Once I was able to admit that, I opened my heart back up to God, and I started changing my life around, but it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. I had to forgive my father. My father had always been in and out of my life, and I had to get to this place where I said, you know what? I'm going to love my father whether he's on drugs or not. But more than that, even if he chooses to go back out to the streets, I cannot allow it to destroy me. I am an adult now. So I have to make my own choices. I have to love him from afar. I'll be there when he's ready. But I can't keep on saying, oh, my daddy was on drugs, so that's why I'm like this. I can't keep on saying, oh, I was molested when I'm 9, so that's why I'm like this. And one of the biggest things with letting it go was, About 6 years ago, I was working at a newspaper as an editorial assistant, and I was watching the news. And on the news, I saw a man in the military was arrested for molesting his daughter. And it was the same guy that molested me. Yep. Same guy who molested me was on the news for molesting his daughter. And it broke my heart. Broke my heart. That started to let me know that I can't hold on to these things, right? You cannot hold on to this. If I had said something a long time ago, which I can't go back now, but I probably could have helped somebody else. I probably could have saved some situations and helped some folks out. And so I said, you know what? Never again will I be the gatekeeper of someone, you know, of the pain that people do to me. Never again will I sit silent and sit back and witness injustices and wrongdoings and say nothing. No longer. And so I started to go through all these different cycles, all these different things. And it was really, really interesting because along that way, when I started piecing my life together and doing things good, I was very close to that creating your own story, you know, right in that little element there. That's around the time that I met my now husband. And I wasn't perfect at that point, but I started making different choices. So I was like, one, no more guys like that, right? My mother was like, in her words, no more projects. No more projects. So you knew good and well when you saw him, he was going to be a project. But you still took it on. No more. So I was like, okay, no more of these. No more. So when I met my husband, my now husband, I was like, oh, my goodness. He's like completely different. You know, it was like, it's funny how when you change yourself, the people that you attract are going to be completely different as well. That was very, very, that was something to me because I always attracted the same kind of guys. They were a lot like my father. Maybe they had drug addictions. Maybe they needed a little extra, you know. They were probably fatherless like me, all of these things. And my husband was very, very different. He was, you know, a two-parent home, which still has its little struggles now because we grew up in different dynamics. But it was like, you know, he was respectful, all these things. He hadn't had a whole line of girlfriends or any of that. It was just completely, completely different. But like I said, we weren't perfect. So we started dating. And we are, you know, in this very, very healthy space. But, of course, like I said, we're not perfect. Into our dating life, I get pregnant with my first son. That was hard. Because I never forget, you know. You're at that place where you're like, what am I going to do? And My mother had contemplated that very thing. She was a teenager then, though, when she had to contemplate what was she going to do. And my mother had an abortion. And I remember her describing to me what happened to her after she had an abortion, just mentally, emotionally, and all these different things. And I remember thinking, like, what am I going to do? I mean, I didn't have very much going for myself. Even though I was changing the person that I was, I didn't have the best paying job. I was living with my grandmother. He was still living, you know, at his parents' house. Even though he was doing well, we still were in these very, very beginning stages. So I'm like, what am I going to do? Well, I chose to keep the baby, and I never forget. About a month into the pregnancy, as soon as my family found out, my oldest brother called me. And my oldest brother, he was the first person in our whole family to graduate from college. So all aunts, uncles, everybody, first person. And remember, I had dropped out from the University of Missouri because my mother told me to come back, so I wasn't actively going to school. So he calls me and he says, man, you just ruined your life. You just ruined your life. And he said, what about all the dreams we had? They all knew that, you know, even though I had gone through so much, I was in a different place. You know, they wanted a library named after me. He had bigger dreams than I did for myself. Because I was like, but he said, you know, he said, what about all of that? And I thought to myself, what about all of that? Is that over now? That's what I would ask myself. Is it over now? And I just had to trust God. You know, I knew I had made a mistake, so I had to ask God for forgiveness. But I said that that's a part of life. Just because you decide that you want to change your life and do things right and you want to walk a different path, that doesn't mean it's going to be narrow. That doesn't mean it's going to be straight. That doesn't mean every now and then you won't, you know, do something that's not always, you won't make mistakes. I did. And so a little later, you know, a few months later into the year, my husband and I got married. And then my son was born the same year we were married. And I felt like, you know, I could still see that good things were happening to us. We didn't have a lot of money. We didn't have a lot of good stuff, but we were solid. He was a very, very good man. My son was born healthy. We were in a good space. And then in 2010, he decided to join the Air Force. And so I was like, okay. You know, I hadn't graduated from college, didn't really have a, you know, stable career going or anything like that. So I'm like, okay. And they tell us, you're going to move to Omaha, Nebraska. Omaha, Nebraska. Let me Google that. I'm asking people around, have you ever been to Omaha? So, Omaha, Nebraska. I was like, oh my goodness. All I was told is that it's going to snow there. I was like, okay. And then I was told that there is a good football team in Lincoln. So I was like, okay. All right. But I was like, I don't know anyone. But this also gives me the chance to be able to decide who I want to be. When I go to Omaha, what person am I taking to Omaha? Does it have to be the girl who, you know, was boy crazy? Does it have to be the girl who, you know, his father's on drugs? Does it have to be the girl who made a lot of mistakes and got in a lot of trouble and was always suspended from school? Does it have to be the girl who hated school? And I said, it doesn't have to be. I can be whoever I want to be. I can decide that. And so while my husband was away at basic training, I was getting our money in order, and I enrolled, and I decided to sign myself up for classes because we were going to be moving to UNO, I mean to Omaha in that summer of 2010. So I enrolled at UNO, and I didn't really like school. I had a very bad feeling anytime I was inside of a school building because I was always that kid that teachers were like, you know, sit right there. What are you doing? You know, I was always under a microscope. So it was very, very difficult. It wasn't an environment that I felt was pleasing to me, and it wasn't fun. It was always the same old same. I'm going to be bored out of my mind. I'm going to write a letter, get in trouble for writing the letter and passing the letter and, you know, things like that. But I decided to go there. And in my very first class, it was a public speaking class, and I took it. It was a class. They had classes at Offutt Air Force Base, so they have a couple classes there. And they had a speech class there. And the teacher, her name was Rita Shaughnessy. And so I'm sitting in that class, and we do it was a how-to speech, and it was, I decided to do how to write a rap, and I thought, oh, well, it just seems easy, you know, I'll come up with this speech, and it'll be fine. I didn't mind that I had to take a public speaking class. Okay, so I took it, and in the class, right afterwards, Rita comes to me, and she says, Tanette, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, well, now I'm pregnant with my second son, and I always have to keep things complicated. And not only, but I'm a military wife and, you know, I'm just kind of just hanging out. I don't know what I'm going to major in. I was a journalism major at first, but I don't think that's the best way to help people. So I don't really know what I want to do. So she said, change your major to speech communication. She said, write some books, become a motivational speaker. And I said, what? Who says that? I didn't know any authors. I didn't know any motivational speakers. I'm like, that's not how, you know, that's not how I dream. I dream, okay, I could do journalism because I used to read this columnist, you know, who I really, really liked. And when I emailed him, he emailed me back. So I thought I had a chance. You know, that's how I dreamed. It was like, but that's crazy. And so I never forget, even when I told my husband was like, what? Why don't you, you know, try to do something else? You could teach, you know, do this, do that. I'm like, you're right. And I called my mom and I called my brothers and called my dad and I called all my family. And I was like, maybe I could. My mom was like, maybe you could. My mom said, I always wanted to write a book. I said, okay, well, I don't know about the book part because writing a news article, you know, a long one, a feature story was enough for me. But I said, well, I can at least try speaking. We'll see. So I started volunteering at places to speak. Started volunteering at like Women's Center for Advancement and places like that where I could share my story and, you know, really just talk to them in the same way, you know, dwelling with them. So just listening to everybody's stories, going back and forth, that same idea. And I think right when I got to UNO, right in that class period, that's when I got to that phase of creating a new story. That's when I got there. That's when I figured out that, you know what, there's more to life than what I've seen. I can dream. I don't have to dream in this box. It doesn't have to be confined. There's not just one style of writing. I don't have to just be a reporter. You can write your own books, and they can be the way you want, and you don't have to use AP style and all of those other guidelines, right? You could do this. You can go somewhere completely different, even if it's not in that little box that you grew up in. And I was like, wow. I started to really, really believe. And so every class that I went to after that, professors always sat me down and said, you know, wow, you have great leadership skills and you have this. And I started thinking to myself, teachers are like that. They believe in you. They feel that way about you. They'll tell you that. They'll invest in you. And it was like this, I went through this, you know, it was like going through something completely, completely different. It was so weird to me. It was a different, it was the biggest motivation ever because I would go home. I was pregnant all through my first year at UNO, but I felt so good. I was so full of energy. I was so, you know, rejuvenized, and I just felt like I can do anything that I want. And so going into my senior year, because I had 2 years at Mizzou, going into my senior year, which was at UNO, at this time my son was born. I had him during final weeks of that first year at UNO. I did. But I got all my finals done, and I made the dean's list every semester. That's shocking to me. When I was at Mizzou, I had like a 1-point-something GPA. Seriously, call Mizzou. Say, are we looking for the student? What was their GPA? We just want to confirm it. They'd probably be embarrassed to tell you that they let me stay there for 2 years with that GPA. But no, seriously. So I'm on the dean's list every semester, and I'm like, oh my goodness, what changed? It wasn't like I learned something in between there. I took these special classes that made me smarter. I changed who I was. I changed how I believed, how I lived, how I felt, how I thought. I released so much that was inside of me. You know, there's an African proverb that says, if there are no enemies on the inside, then the enemies on the outside cannot harm you. That's what happened in my life. I had so many enemies on the inside, and that's why all of these outside things showed up that way. And so my senior year at UNO, this is one of my favorite stories. So I don't get to tell it that often because most people around me already know this story. So I'm glad I get to tell you guys. So my senior year, he was really small, and I had another son who was also very young. They were both, you know, in daycare. And I'm sitting in an argumentation and debate class. So I'm a speech major at this point. And a speech coach, her name is Abby Sirik, she came to me and she said, you want to try out for the speech team? And I was like, oh, well, sure. I was like, I'm a senior. You know, I'm military. You know, my husband's in the military, but I would love to. And she's like, no. We don't recruit seniors. and with all the military, I don't know. Never mind. So I'm like, okay. All right, you know, I understood. So I gave another speech in her class, and she said, wait, you're joining the speech team. We've never had a senior before, but you're joining the speech team. So like, I we'll make it work, you know. And so then I had to sell my husband on that, because joining the speech team means that you're going to be traveling a lot of weekends. So traveling all around the country to go to tournaments to compete against other universities. And I mean, I had two young children, and he's in the military. We already have a lot going on. But he did. He said, okay, you know, let's go for it. It was my senior year. And so I never forget, Abby told me, she said, you know, if you were here for 4 years, I could probably make you a national champion. She said, but you can at least do really, really good this year. And so that was the bar set for me. They wanted me to do really, really good. And we had great people. The UNO, if you're not familiar with that, their speech team is ranked in the nation. One of the smallest speech teams that is ranked in the nation. It's almost nearly impossible to be ranked that high with the number of students that they have competing. And so I did persuasive speaking. That was my thing. I had never done any formal speaking besides the public speaking classes I took at UNO. But they said, you know, what are you passionate about? That's how they determined what you were gonna speak about. And I said, started rattling off stuff, you know, thinking about all the things, you know, I'm real passionate about, you know, working with kids that are in foster care, working with kids who, you know, come from different disadvantaged backgrounds. And then I said, you know, and my father, you know, he's been on drugs for a great deal of my life. And I really think that a big problem with him not being able to receive the help that he needed was all the time he spent in prison. And they're like, that's it. That's it right there. You need to do a speech about the criminalization of addiction. And I thought, really? You know, this is going to be interesting, is that I was going to be telling my story again, you know, in a persuasive speaking style, and it was going to have a lot of research and evidence to back it up, but I was again going to be telling that story. And I'll never forget, because in forensics, I don't know if anybody familiar with speech, how speech works in college? Okay. Well, you stand like this, right? You move on, everybody moves on the same cue. You're real stiff. You talk in the same pitch. Everybody is the same. It's all like this. So my first time that I ever spoke, I was trying to copy everybody else. And I was walking like everybody else and standing like that and speaking in the same way. And it felt weird. My husband came to it and he was like, why was everybody doing that? And I'm like, well, that's how it goes. That's how you compete. And it was very difficult. And I never forget, you know, my coach looked at me and she said, you're going to change the way we do speech. Just be you. So after that first one, I started just being my regular self. You know, I would just speak like I'm speaking to you now with a little bit more passion, because I was talking about something very serious and I had to be very, very persuasive. And so I'll never forget, some of the judges didn't like my style. They hated it. They'd be like, you know, who does she think she is coming in trying to change the way we do speech? You better put your hands to your side and walk like everybody else. And so, but I did not. And that same season that we were competing, we all went to state, so we all qualified for state. And so we get to state, and state is set up where, for persuasive speaking, the judges for the final round are going to be people that are all from the state of Nebraska. They're going to be community leaders. They could be news reporters. They could be politicians. They could be, you know, pastors or university professors, people like that judging. And so I made it to the finals, and everybody was shocked because nobody had high expectations for me. We had other persuasive speakers on our team who did very, very well. And so people would say, you know, oh, yeah, she'll probably win, but, you know, just do your best. Get us some points. So I was the point person. So I made it to finals at state. And, you know, you want to make first or second. If you win first or second at state, then you get to go compete in nationals. And so they called everybody's name. It's always that thing. You're sitting there and they call up, you know, sixth place, fifth place, fourth place, and so forth. And I won at state. And I never forget, one of my first ballots said that they didn't think I could be successful with my speech because it was already talked about before. It wasn't enough, you know, it wasn't speechy enough and what they were used to seeing. And so I went to nationals. I went to nationals the same day as my youngest son's first birthday. We had a little party for him in the daytime, and then I flew out to Boston. And when I was in Boston, I felt like God was carrying me. Seriously, seriously, it's like I was walking on a cloud the whole time I was in Boston. It was the most surreal experience I've ever had. And so we get there, and they have two people from every state. I was representing Nebraska. I thought that was great. I was like, oh, this is great. I'm representing Nebraska. And I really, by that point, I'm feeling like I'm from Nebraska. You know? I mean, I got to be here representing, and I see Texas over there. But y'all about to go down today. That's what, you know. So it's two people from every state. You had the same people who win every year. They were all there. Most of these kids have had, you know, 7 and 8 years of experience, because a lot of people do speech in high school and they carry it all the way through. And so it's very rigorous, and it's so difficult because it's 100 people and 6 people make it to finals. So after going round by round by round by round, they told me that I made it to finals. And I was like, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness, how did I make it to finals with the speech that people doubted? And they said, oh, we don't want to hear about the criminalization of addiction. We want to hear more stuff, you know, different stuff. We want to talk about, you know, war, or we want to talk about all these other things, but we don't want to hear about that. And I'll never forget, when I made it to finals, I actually got discouraged because they told me that it was going to be a panel of Harvard professors. And I thought, nah, they won't like my speech. I thought, surely they're going to like these other speeches more, because I knew all the topics. I'd heard these young men speak. And I should tell you that about finals. Normally, it's a lot of men. I was the only woman in finals. Yeah, because there's research that shows that, you know, people like to hear a man's voice. I knew all that research. I was like, all right, I got to, you know. And the same guys who had been in finals last year, there they were. And they were arrogant. Chest all out. Oh, yeah. One guy, I'm friends with him now, but his chest was all out. And I heard him, he was like, oh, I got this. You know, he saw who else was in the finals. He thought he had it. And I am friends with him now, so I always make fun of him. And he came to me, so I'm like, you know, it was really, really one of those where I'm like, oh my goodness. And my speech coach who came with me, she was one of the grad students, and she said, you can at least get third. And I said, okay. I don't like to lose. I used to play basketball, so I'm real competitive. So I wasn't pleased that she said at least third, but for Nebraska, that would be great, because we hadn't, you know, we had always gotten about fifth or sixth, but nobody had, I think, had been in the top three. And so I gave my speech, and I was like, you know, I put it in God's hands after that, because I thought everybody did a spectacular job. It was the most fierce competition I ever been in. And we all had to stand up. We were in the Boston Public Library in downtown Boston. And they called out, you know, the same way, sixth place, fifth place. And then they got to second place and they didn't say my name. And I just cried. I cried. I could not believe that I won. Could not believe it. Thank you. Thank you. Could not believe it. I mean, it was such a big moment for me, and also for Nebraska. I was the first in UNO history and the only in UNO history to win a national championship in persuasive speaking. It was huge. It was bigger than me, and that made me think, like, oh my goodness, if I could do that, if the same person, I'm telling you guys, if you saw every piece of my life, which it would take more than an hour to tell you every little story of every little thing that I did, but in a nutshell, my mom asked herself several times throughout her life, how could I have given birth to her? She did. She did. She did. She was like, how could I have given birth to her? So for her to have said that so many points in her life, and for me to be on that stage named as the top persuasive speaker in the country, was just, it was so, it meant so much to me. And that showed me that, you know what? There's so much power in telling that story and letting it go. And it's not too late for me. I had made mistakes. I was older than everybody else on the forensics team. I was 26. Everybody else was 19, 18, 20. I was older. So what? So what? I was inexperienced. I had done forensics for 6 months when I won. So what? When God calls you to do something, He will prepare you. Experience won't matter. What you did yesterday, last year, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, it won't matter. And what I'd like to do now is I'd like to read this. This is the chapter from my new book. And I like to read this because this is the way that I look at the transformation. It means a lot to me. So, after I graduated from UNO in 2012, the same year that I won, I published my first book the same year, and it was called The Other Woman. And The Other Woman, I started writing that when we first moved here, and that was kind of like a release for me. So we all need some type of form. We need some way to let go, some way. For some people, it might be counseling. For some people, it might be, you know, constantly talking to God or doing something, you know, talking to someone else, letting them know. It could be a series of things. It could show up in artwork. It could show up in a lot of different forms. For me, it showed up in writing. It showed up in writing. And so I wrote that book, and it's all about, you know, my father's drug addiction and how it impacted my life. It really takes a really, really good look at addiction. It really does. It shows you just how strong it is, how, you know, when we think it's something as easy as just don't go out there anymore, just don't do that. My father explained the addiction to me as something that no scalpel could pull out. And so that's what the first book is about. And then this year, in 2014, I released my second book. And it is called From Daddyless to Destiny because people always ask me, you know, after they read the first book, well, where are you at now? And can you show us that journey? They want the same thing. They want to know, you know, how did you tell your story? How did you let it go? And how did you create that story? And so this chapter is called Finding Freedom in Your Story. My oldest brother, Bashad, once said, just be a butterfly. Get your mind out of the cocoon phase. Spread your wings and fly. He said that with the hope of inspiring people to let go of their past. And while this antidote did inspire some, it also shed light on the problem with our current interpretation of the butterfly metaphor. When I was in grade school, I learned that caterpillars become butterflies. This transformation isn't something they sit down and plot out or plan. It's a natural occurrence. It's in their makeup. But we are not caterpillars. We are people. And if we want to apply that metaphor to our lives, the most important part in the life of a caterpillar or a butterfly is the transformation in the cocoon. For people, that transformation is not natural, it's intentional. I know this because I was a caterpillar for a long time. I felt caged, I felt trapped, I felt lost. I was walking around watching butterflies fly and wondering why I couldn't. I wish someone would have told me caterpillars don't fly. I wish someone would have said that if you're not flying, it's because you have not gone through that transformation. You can't tell a caterpillar to fly. You have to tell a caterpillar that in order to fly, it will have to stop eating, hang itself upside down from a twig or leaf, and spin itself into a cocoon. And while in the cocoon, the caterpillar must digest itself. Most of the caterpillar's cells and tissues will be lost. But some of the cells will survive and be transformed into eyes, wings, legs, and other features of an adult butterfly. We can't literally stop eating, hang ourselves upside down from a twig or any of that. But we can choose to no longer be satisfied with being stuck on the ground. We can make a conscious effort to free ourselves. Unlike a caterpillar, we don't digest ourselves. We digest our past, our stories. We must tell that story, relive it, and go back to all the things that made us who we are today. And much like the caterpillar in the cocoon, we must leave behind and let go of the things in our past that don't belong in our future. I was molested by my brother's friend when I was 9. The night I was molested haunted me most of my life. I had to tell myself, the caterpillar was the victim. The butterfly is the survivor. My father spent more than half of my life in prison. The caterpillar was heartbroken. The butterfly has forgiven him. I always felt like I needed a boyfriend. I felt like a boyfriend defined my worth. But I had to tell myself, the caterpillar needed a boyfriend to define her. When I was in the cocoon, when I was on my journey of healing, it wasn't easy. There were days when I wished I hadn't put myself in the cocoon. There were days I wanted to go back to being a caterpillar because it seemed easier. But I kept thinking back to what it felt like to feel caged. What it felt like to feel worthless. And I kept going. I wrote, I spoke, and I cried my story out. And little by little, I saw wings in the form of confidence and healthy choices. No longer did I think about being molested more than I thought about being loved. No longer did it hurt to think about my childhood. No longer did I need to wake up or go to sleep to text messages from the opposite sex. It took some time, but I remember what it felt like the first time I tried to walk, and instead I was flying. It was the evening I had dinner by myself at an Outback Steakhouse in San Antonio, Texas. I was sitting there alone, just having just told a handful of guys that I no longer wanted to talk to them. It was a few months after walking away from a no-good guy who I thought I was in love with. Everything in my life didn't change overnight. Telling and letting go of my story didn't make me a millionaire, nor did it change every exterior part of my life, but it gave me what I needed to keep going. It gave me what I needed to finish writing my story the way I wanted to. No caterpillar starts out a butterfly. We must all go through the cocoon phase. We can't rush the development process, and we have to realize that every caterpillar is not the same. So to you, I say, if you want to fly, build your cocoon. Go through the transformation. You have to tell your story, and you have to be willing to let go of the parts of your life that are no good for you. It is the only way to freedom, the only way to fly. And so, to bring it all home on where I'm at now, it's funny because, as she said, you know, I have two sons and I'm expecting another one. I know some of you are like, well, I'm glad, you know, I'm glad it's announced that I was pregnant. Otherwise, you might be looking at my belly like, oh, she might need to lose a little weight or she could work out a little bit. No, I'm pregnant, so I can have this. No, but, you know, so it's really exciting for me because I didn't envision this for myself. I never saw myself married with children or any of that. You know, last year I started a nonprofit organization, and it's called The Truth Heals. And I started that organization because that summer of 2013, I went to Oprah's Life Class. And at Oprah's Life Class, they had a whole show about all for women who grew up without fathers. And, you know, my mother, she said, you should write in. And I was like, okay, I'll write in, but I didn't expect to get a call. Well, 4 days later, they were like, we want you to come. And so I was like, okay. So when I get there, you know, it was about maybe about 50 women and maybe about 50 other supporters with them. And everybody was so hurt. I was sitting next to women who were still, who still hadn't let go. They still hadn't learned how to release and tell those stories. And they were walking around looking for that wholeness and hoping that as they were sitting, you know, on Oprah's Life Class, that that's what would give them that wholeness. And it was not, you know, it was an hour show. So after the show, a lot of them were upset. They were like, oh, that didn't help me. I'm still hurting. Well, of course you are. That's not how it works. It's not, we can't snap a, you know, a snap a finger and we're better or we're over it. And so I started mentoring some of the women who were there. And I started working with a woman out of Chicago. And she was in a place where her father wanted to reunite with her. She was a little older than me. And she said, you know, but I can't find a way to forgive him. Her father was just very similar to mine. He had a drug addiction, but he was in a better place now. So I started working with her. And from the time I started working with her, which was August of 2013, to now, her and her father have Sunday dinner every Sunday. You know, they, when he helped her paint her house, and they have this great relationship that didn't happen overnight, but she went through that same phase of telling your story and letting it go and deciding that I'm going to create a new story. And because my father isn't a good place, just because I didn't grow up with him doesn't mean I have to grow up without him. You know, so it was, it's been really, really interesting because we started the organization and it's been great. As she said in the introduction, you know, we've been able to get into a lot of great places and we're still doing that work. And even still, when you think of that and you might admire the journey and say it's great, it doesn't mean that my life is perfect. It doesn't mean that it's always that I don't make mistakes because I still do. You can ask my husband afterwards. So I'm sure he'll tell you that, you know. So he told me I was being a little mean to him earlier. So I'm like, okay, I'm sorry. So I still, you know, it's still, it's regular things that, you know, you still got to live your life. You're still not going to always do it right. Are there days when I still have bad days? Absolutely. Absolutely. But because I've gone through all this work, I know what to do on those bad days, and I know that those bad days are not going to last. And I know that I'm not going to give them power to control my life. And so, you know, I don't know where everybody is in their stages of life. Even if you're in a, you know, no matter where you are, we all have this journey. We all have this journey. And the idea to remember is that I can't make you whole and you can't make me whole. But once we get to that wholeness, we surely can complement each other. We surely can do some great works together. That's the message that I want you guys to take away from tonight. And I thank you for having me here and allowing me to tell you my story and for you listening, you know, without the technology and without all the fancy stuff, because I really do believe in the power of dwelling with each other and you coming together and fellowshipping with each other, because I believe that that's where the greatest stories are told and the greatest impact is made. So thank you. Thank you.
If you'd like to ask any questions of Tanette, we can take a few minutes of questions and answers.
Talk a little bit more about that book you did for OPS.
Okay, great. So last summer, they found 8 authors, local authors, in the Omaha area, and 8 teachers that were all either third grade or fourth grade teachers, and they had 8 illustrators. And they had us write different books. So mine was on World War II. And what, you know, in Nebraska on the home side. And then they had other ones. They had, you know, people that looked specifically at 24th Street, you know, during a certain period of time and things like that. What I have been told by OPS, who is, you know, the guy who's over the social studies department, is that it's not being used like it should. Because how the books were developed, they're very, very unique. You can go look at it online for free. If you go to my website, you'll see a little tab where you can go to it and read it because it is free. It's an iBook. So they did that on purpose to go with, you know, technology and things like that. So what happens is it's not just the book. There are questions. It's a whole, you know, it's very, very interactive for the classroom. But I don't think it's being used in every fourth grade class. But it is being used in some of them. Definitely not enough. OPS got a grant. They have that program called Making Invisible Histories Visible, right? And so through the grant dollars that they got, they developed it. But it is available. I mean, anybody can download it and use it. So even if you're not in, you know, in Omaha, so you don't have to be OPS to use it. It is very, very neat. It's really, really neat. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Tanette Powell, co-founder and chief executive officer of The Truth Heals, a nonprofit advocacy group for women and youth affected by fatherlessness, and the author of The Other Woman, about her father's drug addiction and its effects on her, and From Daddyless to Destiny, Finding Freedom in Your Story. She spoke on the topic, The Truth Heals, One Woman's Journey to Wholeness. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 9, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Kelly Keller, director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.